Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
As much as President Obama might like for this to be true,
everything there is to say about healthcare has been said, and just about everybody has said it.
There is way more to talk about on healthcare. What the president said today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 3rd of March. It is great to be back, and it is great to have you here. I know I have said this before, but this time, I think I really mean it. The end of the healthcare debate may finally be upon us. The president is certainly ready for it to be over with. And to that end, he put on the full bully pulpit press in the East Room of the White House today, the formal unveiling of his overhaul proposal. We've got our health desk reporter Gregory Warner on the line from WHYY in Philadelphia with us. Hi, Gregory.
Hello, Kai.
I was watching the president today, as I know you were. Seemed like a lot of familiar ground that he covered.
This is pretty much what we saw in the Senate bill. We have coverage to 31 million people, a system of government-run exchanges where people could buy insurance. There are some new things in the president's plan that he didn't mention in this speech, but he talked about in a letter to Congress last night. One is he's going to do more to go after Medicare fraud. Also, he's looking at increasing Medicaid payments to doctors. Thirdly, he's going to make health savings accounts more accessible, and these are these tax-sheltered accounts for people to put money away to pay for their own health care. And finally, he's going to get more aggressive around malpractice reform. And I should just mention that this is not what the Republicans have been calling for with capping rewards that juries can give in malpractice cases, but rather setting up specialized courts to just take the whole thing out of the legal system.
Can't talk the economics of healthcare policy without talking the politics of healthcare policy. So anything in there that's going to change votes on either side?
Well, look, the president has gone after health insurance executives and skyrocketing costs of premiums. That's certainly popular on both sides of the aisle. And to hold down premiums, it's pretty much agreed by economists that you got to get more healthy people into the pool of people being covered. That's just the way insurance works. And right now, the opposite is happening, where people are getting priced out of the system. So the president's plan has this mandate that every American buy insurance, and it gives them subsidies. This is this middle-class tax credit he's talking about to do so. What Republicans say and have been saying is that this just brings more people into a broken system, and it does not address the problem of the cost of care.
But the president said specifically today, my plan is paid for. How's he going to take care of the costs?
Well, right, because when we talk about costs, we're really talking about two things. One is the cost that is wrapped up with access. If someone walks into an emergency room and they don't have insurance, the cost of treating them goes somewhere. Hospitals are going to shift that cost to private insurers, or increasingly the government, which now pays for half of all health care costs in this country. So what the president is going to argue is, well, we're paying either way. But there's another cost, which is the complexity of the system and this incentive-based system that rewards more tests, more treatments, and not much is being done about that at all.
Briefly, Gregory, what happens now? Where do we go in Congress?
Well, since Republicans are firmly against the plan and Democrats don't have a 60-vote majority they'd need, the only plan in place is a parliamentary procedure called reconciliation. And that's basically you can filibuster a bill, but you can't filibuster a bill if it affects the federal budget. And so congressional Democrats would make that argument about health care, that they can use this parliamentary procedure
Gregory Warner at the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, so we are going to turn now from healthcare policy to something only slightly less dense, monetary policy. That is, when you get right down to it, a fancy way of saying interest rates. Over the past couple of years, the Fed has done everything in its power, and some say many things beyond its power, to keep interest rates low. The Fed has made sure there's plenty of money available to banks that might need it. One way they've done that is with something called the Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility, or better known, mercifully, by its acronym, TALF. Tomorrow is the deadline for lenders to take advantage of the TALF before it goes away at the end of the month. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale explains now the latest indication that Ben Bernanke is taking the training wheels off the American economy.
In the depths of the 2008 credit crisis, investors in securities made up of things like small business loans and mortgages lost confidence that the assets behind the loans would hold value. Lending became too risky, so the Federal Reserve created the TALF program to back up the assets behind the loans. Donald Cohn is the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board.
So we said, on very conservative terms, we will lend to finance the purchase of these loans in order to get the loans made and the funds flowing to households and businesses.
The program lent more than $46 billion to investors in asset-backed securities. Reid Auerbach, a partner with Bingham McCutcheon, says a year later, lending is finally getting back to normal levels.
And yet the use of TALF for what I would call non-esoteric assets like auto loans and credit cards has largely declined as a percentage of the deals because it's not needed anymore.
But Auerbach says lenders are still worried that some jolt to the market could hurt lending again. And there has been a spurt of last-minute Fed-supported loans. Vice Chairman Cohn says that's because some areas of lending, especially student loans, still haven't gained the full confidence of private investors.
But it's still time. I think it's time to take away the prop and allow the markets to find their own function and do their own pricing.
More training wheels come off at the end of March when the Fed stops purchasing mortgage-backed securities. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in the Federal Reserve building in Washington today, the central bank released its beige book, a region-by-region survey of how things are going economy-wise. Soft but better was the general gist. On Wall Street today, though, you'd have never known that. The major indices gave up what gains they had. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We got an early taste of the state of the labor market as of the end of February today. ADP, the company that does a whole lot of payroll paperwork for American companies, reported this morning that the economy only lost 20,000 jobs last month, better than expected. We'll get the official Department of Labor figure Friday morning, but it's a safe bet the unemployment rate isn't going to be too far from either side of 10%. In this month's Atlantic Magazine, Don Peck explores what happens when so many people are out of work for so long. Don, welcome to the program.
Good to be here, Kai.
Can you quantify for us how deep the employment hole that we're in actually is?
It's quite deep. It's about 10 million jobs deep. In fact, that's the number that would be required to get us back to the 5% unemployment rate that we had before this recession began. That's a huge hole. Even if you assume very robust growth, you still need about 2 years to get back to the level we had before the recession.
So given the fact that gross domestic product is growing in the past couple of quarters, the phrase jobless recovery then is apt.
It's interesting. In every recession since the early 1980s, it's taken longer and longer to recover the jobs lost in that recession. So yes, it's been a jobless recovery so far. And I think there are some good reasons peculiar to this recession to think that it will be particularly long this time around.
Well, what might they be then?
We had a decade-long housing bubble, and as a result, the housing sector and the financial sector became distorted. And I don't think anyone expects either of those two sectors to return to their previous size anytime soon. So for that reason, you know, there are a lot of construction workers and financial professionals that even once demand returns, they're not going to be able to simply return to work. They're going to have to retrain and find new jobs.
And that really is the gist of your article. It's what happens to people who are out of work for longer and the social effects that it has.
when people think 5% versus 10% unemployment, you know, it's a big difference, but it doesn't seem that big. What really makes it a huge deal is that most of that increase is in chronic unemployment.
For example, take a 55-year-old man who's out of work now for a year or more. What happens in his home life? What happens in his neighborhood? I mean, break all that down.
We know from psychological studies that being without work for involuntarily for 6 months or more is really about the worst thing that can happen to someone. It's equivalent to the death of a spouse, and it is a kind of bereavement in its own right. And we also know that the happiness of husbands and wives and children are pretty closely related typically. So that 55-year-old man, if he loses his job, is likely to have some real mental health issues, and that's likely to spread throughout the home. Marriages sour. Divorce is common following a long bout of unemployment, and especially male unemployment. And also in communities where you have high rates of joblessness, and again, especially male joblessness, you find the character of those communities tends to change over time.
Do we just, we men that is, do we just give up?
Well, we can't do that. And in fact, this is an era where hustle and adaptability and humility are, of course, necessary. But it's an awfully tough time. I mean, there are 6 unemployed people for every job opening in the U.S. right now. And over time, I mean, this has been called the man's session, but that's really just an acceleration of a long-term trend. Men in their prime working age have their lowest participation in the labor market today since 1948.
Why has this recession had such lasting effect, or what we anticipate will be lasting effect? Why is it so different than recessions in the last 10 to 15 years?
For 2 joint reasons. You know, this recession has been extremely deep in the job losses we've seen. I mean, we did see an unemployment rate a little bit higher than what we have now in 1981. And it's been so far of a long duration as well. I mean, the 80s recession was really a recession that was induced by the Fed to quell inflation. We could get out of it almost whenever we wanted to by the Fed reducing rates. And that, in fact, happened. You know, this is a very different kind of recession. It's just a situation that we as a country have not been in for a long, long time.
Don Peck, he's a deputy managing editor at the Atlantic Monthly. His article in this month's issue is called How a New Jobless Era Will Transform America. Don, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
There's this on the Toyota story to pass along today. The Transportation Department says it's hearing from Toyota drivers, drivers whose cars have already been repaired, that they're still having problems, acceleration of the unintended kind. No comments so far from the company on those new complaints. These comments, though, from David Frum.
Curiously shapeless, defiantly small, the first Toyota Corollas stood out amid the huge land yachts of the mid-1970s. They said, "I'm opting out of the Chevrolet, Oldsmobile, Buick status hierarchy. A car is transportation, that's all. I want reliability and mileage, not the pseudo-luxury of Ricardo Montalban's Corinthian leather." It was not only the cars themselves that challenged Detroit. It was the way the cars were made. Lifetime employment. Workers empowered to stop the line for a quality defect. Everyone eating in the same dining room, wearing the same coveralls. Okay, the morning company calisthenics and Anthem were a bit creepy, but otherwise, Toyota rebuked the worst practices of American labor management relations. Perhaps most important, in an era where the Ford Motor Company knowingly sold a fatally defective car, the Pinto, because it would cost too much to re-engineer it, Toyota epitomized quality above all. A generation ago, Americans lived with a level of defect in their products almost unimaginable today. Refrigerator doors didn't close properly. Toasters burned out after 6 months. 8-track cassettes unspooled all over the passenger seat. The yearning for something better made an unlikely folk hero of Edward Deming. He was an American statistician who had arrived in Japan to assist with the first post-war census. Deming argued that quality could be engineered into products. Japanese companies listened. Made in Japan, once a synonym for the cheap and breakable, became an international guarantee of reliability. Only after losing to the Japanese did American companies accept Deming's teachings. Zero defects began as a slogan and grew into an expectation. This global quality revolution was Toyota's doing as much as any single company's. when those brakes slipped, they betrayed not only Toyota's customers, but an ideal.
Commentator David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. You can share your thoughts with us. Go to marketplace.org, that's our website, and click on the link that says contact. Coming up, DNA and the entrepreneurial spirit.
One of the things we've known for years is that the children of entrepreneurs are much more likely than anybody else to become an entrepreneur.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials drained off 9 points today, a 10th percent, closed at 10,396. The NASDAQ pretty much flat, closed at 2280 for the second day in a row. The S&P 500 also flat, ended things at 1118. Two reports helped steady the markets. The one from ADP I mentioned that says the U.S. lost fewer private sector jobs than expected. Also, the Institute for Supply Management came out with an encouraging report on service industry growth. DineEquity, the owner of Applebee's and IHOP restaurants, piled up a 12% gain today after beating analysts' expectations. Dow components Caterpillar, Alcoa, DuPont, and General Electric all ticked up about 2/3 of 1%. The software company Novell shot up 28% today on the heels of yesterday's announced takeover bid by a hedge fund. Radio Shack charged up 6% on speculation that a private equity firm may buy that electronics company. Bond prices fell, though. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.62%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Did consumers brave last month's storms to get to the mall? Major retailers report sales figures. The Labor Department releases its revised fourth quarter productivity and costs report. And get your red pen out. Tomorrow is National Grammar Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know how we've been saying on this broadcast for pretty much ever that nothing sustainable is going to happen to get the economy back where it ought to be until consumers start spending again? And you know how month after month we report on retail sales figures that are, by and large, disappointing? Well, there may be change a-coming. A report out today from MasterCard found consumers have started buying again without retailers having to resort to the extreme discounts that we've come to know and love. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
Millions of people have lost their jobs, and wages aren't getting any better. But somehow, people are shopping again. Retail sales are expected to grow 2% in the first half of this year. Frank Badillo is an economist with Kantar Retail. He says that's because some of the people who stopped shopping didn't actually need to. And now that sympathy saving is easing up.
The stock markets have bounced back, and shoppers see that perhaps their wealth losses aren't as severe as they were a year ago. Those people who cut back for the sake of precaution, they're now feeling more comfortable to spend.
And they're finding prices aren't what they used to be. Retailers have backed away from the mega markdowns they were using to lure shoppers last year. Retail consultant Milton Pedraza says stores have gotten recession savvy. They're more strategic about markdowns and more careful about what they stock.
It's sort of like a recalibrating on the part of retailers to make sure that they do bring people in. I think the other piece is, you know, they're keeping inventories limited so that they have to discount less and that people have to pay full price.
But there are still some big barriers to real retail sales growth, says Conference Board economist Lynn Franco. She points out that even now, sales are less than half of what they are in a robust economy.
the flow of cash and credit is not what it used to be. So while their desire to shop may return, their ability is going to continue to be hampered.
Franco says a real recovery will probably take a couple of years. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Google, as you probably know, controls almost two-thirds of the internet search market. That doesn't sit too well with some of Google's competitors, including one that knows a little something about market domination. In a speech yesterday, Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer said he has complained to antitrust regulators about Google. His company has filed antitrust suits against him over in Europe. And recently, a number of smaller companies have filed lawsuits against Google here at home. Companies whose lawyer, it just so happens, used to represent Microsoft. Brett Neely has more.
John Lopatka is an antitrust expert at Penn State. His reaction to these cases?
It's all in some ways a little amusing.
That's because a decade ago, the government sued Microsoft for abusing its market power. Now Microsoft says the same about its rival Google. Lawsuits like these are the price of success, says Google spokesman Adam Kovacevich.
It's become clear to us that over the last several months, our competitors are looking at court dockets for complaints against Google in which they can inject themselves and learn more about our business.
But an antitrust case probably won't unearth much competitive information, says Neil Ray at the law firm Shepard Mullin.
The antitrust suit avenue is not an easy way to attempt to gain access to competitive information.
Lawsuits take a long time and can be unpredictable. But Ray says the Obama administration is more sympathetic to antitrust complaints. John Lopatka says Microsoft can now turn to the government and it will listen.
Microsoft has said, and I think correctly so, that complaints about anti-competitive behavior that are made to antitrust authorities often come from competitors.
And remember this. Though the U.S. antitrust case against Microsoft was eventually dismissed, there was a price. Many of the company's products have lost market share since then. The question is, will these current lawsuits cost Google its momentum? In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
This was news to me, but people who study these sorts of things have apparently known for a good long time that entrepreneurship tends to run in families. Mom starts a software firm, dad launches maybe an environmental marketing business, and chances are pretty good that at least some of the kids are also going to want to work for themselves when they grow up. The question researchers are asking now is nature or nurture? Could there actually be an entrepreneurial gene that predisposes somebody to the startup lifestyle? From the non-hereditary Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
Dad, you were in a dream last night.
I was.
I don't remember what.
Meet the Jennings family of Portland. They're an entrepreneurial geneticist's dream. Dad, age 61.
I'm Charles Jennings. I've been an entrepreneur since 1970. I've started over 20 companies. One has gone public, another was sold for $250 million, and I've had my failures.
Mom, age 60.
I'm Christine Jennings. My first business was called Honey Treats.
And their two grown daughters.
My name is Faith Jennings. I tried several different business models and finally hit on one that worked a few years ago, Faith Jennings Designs.
I'm Nayana Jennings, and I started my first company on March 4th, 2003, and the business is March 4th Marching Band.
The sisters are dancers and part owners in the 40-piece drum and brass band. It tours worldwide. Nayana also has a marketing business. Faith designs a line of hats and sweaters.
One of the things we've known for years is that the children of entrepreneurs are much more likely than anybody else to become an entrepreneur.
Scott Shane is a business professor at Case Western Reserve and author of the new book, Born Entrepreneurs, Born Leaders, How Your Genes Affect Your Work Life. He says until now, most researchers have considered entrepreneurship something that people learn.
the parents are putting them in touch with certain kinds of people that have financing and customers and suppliers and so forth. Nobody ever said, well, maybe it's because there's something innate and that's being passed on from parents to children.
Shane argues people who launch businesses tend to share certain inherited traits, like independence, tolerance for risk, ability to recognize opportunity, and leadership. He's even put a hard number to nature versus nurture.
About a third to 40% of the tendency to be an entrepreneur is innate.
Knowing which genes encourage entrepreneurship and who has them could help educators design better programs to spur business creation. It could even help venture capitalists pick whose startup to fund, though there's no guarantee the genes actually lead to success. Still, many researchers doubt we'll ever be able to pinpoint exactly what role environment and genes play in raising up entrepreneurs.
I must have been born with that instinct to change the world, to shake things up.
Charles Jennings launched his first enterprise, a statewide student association in California, at age 16. He's on year 9 of his latest startup. It develops communication systems for first responders. Jennings' parents were business owners. His grandfather chased down outlaws with Wyatt Earp.
We're a family of risk takers, and we're willing to try to create something new.
Even when the risk is going broke, says daughter Nayana.
I do remember the occasional strife in the family about how are we going to make ends meet? We're at the bottom of the barrel, and there was always some new opportunity that came along.
Another entrepreneurial trait the Jennings have in spades, confidence, even overconfidence.
There's a stick-to-itiveness to go beyond the point where maybe you should have let the business fail and keep with it long enough for the times to catch up with the idea.
Of course, all of this could be learned from mom and dad rather than passed on through their genes. Except, did I mention, Faith and Nayana are identical twins who have pursued more or less identical entrepreneurial paths for the past 20 years. There's also an older sibling, says mother Christine.
Their brother, who is not in the least bit entrepreneurial. He went to college, he got a job, he got another job, and I doubt that he will ever work for himself.
In a family full of entrepreneurs, that might be the most rebellious act of all. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today before we go, picking up where David Frum left off, talking about Toyota. If company executives aren't sure the recall will fix what's wrong with their cars, Edmunds.com has an idea. The auto information website is offering $1 million to anybody who can figure out what's causing and then fix Toyota's unintended acceleration problems. No details yet. The contest officially starts next month. It's $1 million total, by the way, not $1 million each for every person who figures it out. Edmunds swears the whole thing is not a publicity stunt, despite all the publicity we just gave him, I guess. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 9 points, a 10%, closed at 10,396. The NASDAQ flat, closed at 2280 for the second day in a row. The S&P 500 flat as well, ended things at 1118. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest and earliest in business and economic news. Next time on this broadcast, with recession comes a whole lot of unhappy workers.
I'm not necessarily doing what I was trained to do. I don't think I'm acquiring new skills. Still, I don't want to have a hole in my resume. Times are tough.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.